Major General Francis Fightin' Frank Bollinger, a longtime admirer of John Big John Iselin, consented with a great deal of pleasure to Raymond's mother's suggestion that he head a committee of patriots called 10 Million Americans Mobilizing for Tomorrow. This was at a small dinner, so small that it fed only Johnny, the general, and Mrs. Iselin at the Iselin residence in Washington in January 1960. Bollinger pledged, with all of his big heart, that on the morning of the opening of his party's presidential nominating convention to be held at Madison Square Garden in July, he would deliver 1 million signatures of 1 million patriots petitioning that John Yerkes Iselin be named the party's candidate for the presidency. General Bollinger had retired from active duty to take up the helm of the largest dog food company the world had ever known. He had often said, in one of the infrequent jokes he made, it does not matter what the other joke was, which by reason of the favoritism he felt for it, he repeated not infrequently,
"I'd sure as hell like to see the commies try to match muscle, pal. But if they ever did try it, they'd probably call it Moscow, pal. Get it?"
Laughter. He had been a patriot himself for many years. Marco's unit waited out the winter and the spring without any action or any leads. In March, the FBI learned that Raymond's name appeared on the final list of possible suspects in connection with the murder of the anti-communist deputy, François Ursel, the previous June. Later that month, they also learned that Raymond's name appeared on a similar listing prepared by Scotland Yard in conjunction with the murder of Lord Crofternell. The French listing included 8 names of Americans or foreigners then in the United States who could be placed anywhere near the scene of the crime. The Scotland Yard list contained 3 such names. Both agencies asked for a routine FBI check and comment. Raymond's name was the only name to appear on both listings. In late May, Senator and Mrs. Iselin took a house on Long Island, anticipating the social demands of the political convention, and so that, Mrs. Iselin explained, she could lend a woman's touch in preparing for the imminent homecoming of Senator Jordan's widowed daughter, Josie, she and her father being old, old friends. She confided all of this to the society editor of the Daily Press after asking Raymond to ask the society editor to call her. It remained for Raymond to read the news about Josie's homecoming as any other reader of the newspaper might, and he became savage in the fury of his resentment when he reached her on the telephone. Raymond's mother allowed him to curse and cry out at her until she was sure he had finished. He spoke for nearly 4 minutes without stopping, the sound of the words like a stream of bullets, his phrasing erratic and his breathing heavy. When she was sure of his pause, she invited him to a costume ball she was staging on the very day of Josie's return from Buenos Aires. She said she was sure that he would accept, because Josie had already accepted, and that it had been a dog's age since he and Josie had met. She maintained her control all during Raymond's, shouted obscenities and screamed vituperation. Then she hung up the instrument with such vigor that she knocked it off her desk. She was drawn forward into an even blacker rage. She picked the telephone up and ripped it out of the wall and crashed it through a glass-topped table 4 feet away. She picked up the shattered table and flung it through the short corridor that led to the open bathroom door, disclosing warm pink tile behind the glass shower curtain. The table splintered the glass, crashed through to the tile wall, and fell noisily in the tub. After a sleepless, tortured night, Raymond, who had decided he must get to the office at 7 o'clock the following morning to do what he had to do, finally fell asleep near dawn and slept through until 11. He nearly knocked Chun Jin down when the man said good morning, because he had not troubled to call him when he knew that Raymond never, never, never slept later than 8 o'clock in the morning. When Raymond got to the office, he locked the door behind him. Using the nastiest voice tone in his ample store, he told the telephone switchboard that they were not to ring his telephone no matter who called.
"Including Mr. Downey, sir?"
"Yes."
"And Mr. O'Neill, sir?"
"Everyone, anyone. Can you get that through your heads?"
"Heads, sir? I have one head, sir."
"I'm sure," Raymond snapped. "Then are you able to get it through your head? No calls, do you understand?"
"Bet on it, sir. Everything. Bet your house, your clothes."
"Bet?" "Oh, one moment there. I will revise my orders. I will take any calls from Buenos Aires. You probably pronounce that Buenos Aires. I will accept calls from there."
"Which, sir?"
"Which what?"
"Which city?"
"I don't understand."
"Buenos Aires or Buenos Aires, sir?"
"It's the same place."
"Very good, sir. You will accept calls from either or both. Now, would you like to revise those orders, sir?"
Raymond hung up his phone as she was speaking.
"Oh boy, oh boy, oh boy," the operator said to the girls working on either side of her. "Am I going to get that one someday? I wouldn't care if I was offered 4 times the money on some other job, which had half the hours. I would never leave this here job as long as he works here. Someday, I may be a little old lady sitting at the switchboard, but someday, the day will come, and oh boy, oh boy, oh boy."
She was grinding her teeth as she talked.
"Who, Shaw?"
the girl on her left asked. "What's the use?" the girl on her right said. "If you get that offer for 4 times the money, you take it. Nobody is ever going to be able to do anything about Shaw."
Dear Josie, this is a difficult letter to get written. It is nearly an impossible letter for a weak and frightened man to write. And I have surprised myself with that sentence because I have never thought that of myself, and I have never said anything less than a sufficiency about myself. I will set down at the outset that I am going to open myself up to you, and that it will probably be a long, long letter, so that, should it hurt you to read any such things any further, you may stop now, and it will all be over. To have to love you as much as I do, as I did was what I had started to write, so that I could plot its progression and its growth over the 9 empty and useless years without you. And to feel my love for you grow and grow and grow, and to have no place to store this enormous harvest within the emptiness, I have found that I must carry it ahead of me wherever I go, bundled in my arms like old clothes, which no one else can use and no one wants, but which have warmth in them still if someone, as bleakly cold as I have been, can be found to wear them. You will return to New York next month. I have started this letter almost 30 times, but I cannot postpone writing it and mailing it for another day, because if I do, it may not reach you. I cannot write this letter, but I must write this letter because I know that I have not got the character nor the courage, the habit of hope nor the assurance that comes from having a place in a crowded world, and I could never be able to speak to you about this long pain and bitterness, which... He stopped writing. He had smudged the paper with several genuine tears.